Justify. Prove to be right or reasonable. Justification is at the heart of all legal and political argument. But at a time when argument itself is slave to appearances, it is time to bring back a culture of justification. Justify, a podcast on law and politics in India from the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, hosted by Orgho Sengupta.
Welcome to another episode of Justify. As India prepares to go to the polls, this season is dedicated to examining issues of law and policy which shape our nation. Welcome to Justify. As India prepares to go to the polls, this season of Justify is dedicated to examining 11 issues of law and policy which, in our view, should affect how the youth vote. Today, we'll discuss the internet and its relevance to the youth vote, how it's currently relevant, and how it ought to perhaps be a little more relevant. The internet and the digital economy has been the new frontier. For India, it presents immense opportunities. The Prime Minister has spoken about it a number of times, including pointing to the need for India to become a $1 trillion digital economy. And with a substantial demographic dividend and increasing digital penetration, there are many reasons to be optimistic. But there are many reasons to be cautious as well. Any targeted scheme to enhance the size of the digital economy at the level of the subcontinent is guaranteed to be an extremely complicated task, beset by implementational challenges, problems of exclusion. We have seen many of this playing out with Aadhaar. We have seen many of this in several DBT schemes of the government. Has great promise, but also has several implementational difficulties. Given that the youth is likely to be the biggest beneficiary of the expansion of the digital economy, it is essential to look at this issue from their lens. A lot has been happening. The Digital Personal Data Protection Act has been passed. There is a possibility of a dedicated law on digital competition. The Broadcasting Regulation Bill has been tabled. The artificial intelligence has emerged, and now we are looking at various ways to regulate it, including an ill-advised advisory by METI requiring prior permission for artificial intelligence products, thankfully, subsequently withdrawn. Today, to discuss all this and more, we have Anirudh Nigam. Anirudh was formerly a senior resident fellow at the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy and working on law and technology issues. And currently, he's pursuing a master's in public administration from Princeton University. Anirudh, welcome back to Justify.
Thank you, Agya. It's a pleasure to be here and always a pleasure to speak to you.
And thank you for doing it. What I think it must be the middle of the night in Princeton. So you were always a bit of a night bird. So, but still, thank you very much for burning the midnight oil, literally, for doing this. So let's jump right in. So data from the World Bank shows that in 2022, only 46% of India's population had access to the internet. So if only one out of two people have access to the internet, then is it that we are getting ahead of ourselves by talking about the benefits of the digital economy being this game changer for Indian politics as well as governance in the country?
The short answer to that question is we aren't getting ahead of ourselves, but yes, there are groups that face significant disadvantages in accessing the digital economy. I suspect across many dimensions of inequality, gender, literacy, income levels, caste, groups will lack access to the digital economy, which is a part of the economy. We also should put this number in perspective, I think, because we have gone from 12% in 2012 to 46 in 2022. So the signs are good. And even though some people think smartphone sales are stagnating, the number of internet connections has gone up consistently. And I suspect this will only go up as the economy grows in India. The long answer, I think the long answer is that some of this will show up in the data and some of this will not show up in the data that easily. But it's quite important to bookend all of this discussion also with the idea that these excluded groups are the ones for whom I think the digital economy holds the most promise. And I can dive into some examples.
For example, why do you say that?
So take the example of giving women agency over their finances in India. This has been perhaps an intractable problem in development in India, given household dynamics and gender dynamics across the country. What the Jandhan Aadhaar mobile scheme, along with direct benefit transfers, promises is a pathway to breaking down this problem. If subsidies are directly transferred to women who have the digital literacy to know how to operate their payment services and know how to operate their identity authentication, and who have those devices and internet connection, I think something that has been a wicked problem for many, many years seems to finally have some sort of a solution through technology.
But isn't this a bit of tech evangelism that we feel that patriarchy, which is an institution as old as humanity itself, will suddenly wither away, or even if not wither away, will suddenly be seriously challenged because now the woman has a mobile phone in her hand? Don't we think that we are being perhaps a little bit too simplistic and unoptimistic perhaps?
I think this type of thinking can often devolve into less optimism. But I think if we are cautiously optimistic, I think we are treading on solid ground. I think technology has always reshaped society and societal norms. And I think different technologies across the ages, if you look at a 200 or 300 year time scale, have often caused very fundamental changes in how society is organized. I think phones, smartphones, and the internet offer that promise. So I do think there is a lot of credence to the argument that giving people access to phones, to the internet, and the ability to use those services can change or reshape some of these dynamics. It won't upend the patriarchy.
But... Of course. No, so the question that arises then is that, okay, suppose let's assume, as you have said, that now it's 1 out of 2, but very soon, you know, every single person who is an adult and has access to the internet in some form or the other. Data is cheap, and so people don't think twice about using it. Let's assume this hypothetical scenario. Now, what are the behavioral changes that you think are then necessary to ensure that this person, let's say this person from a disadvantaged group, say woman, Dalit, or minority group living in some remote part of the country, what further changes now necessary for this person to be able to get the fruits of the digital economy now that they have access to it?
So I think, number one, a lot of this is facetious if we don't complement this with digital literacy efforts and outreach so that the mobile is not just something on which you watch TikTok reels, but the mobile is a way to make payments, perhaps start your own business, perhaps access information about schemes, subsidies, remedies, etc. I think the second thing that necessarily needs to be done is we also need to develop use cases for people in these disadvantaged groups. So people can have phones and can know how to use the internet, but unless there is a use case that drives adoption and that drives those behaviors, we are looking at a degree of error in how this translates on the ground. So I think with increases in digital literacy, combined with creating specific use cases for technology that meet the needs of disadvantaged groups, I think we start moving towards that direction.
Yeah, and I think this reminds me of an example. So this organized, wonderful organization called Hak Darshak, which is essentially working with disadvantaged groups using technology as an intermediary in helping people access entitlements and benefits, and it's a very interesting model. I urge the listeners to check it out, where Hak Darshak as an intermediary uses technology to assist the end user in accessing whatever pension or subsidy or other entitlement that they have. So I think this is the kind of example that Anirudh perhaps is talking about, where we are essentially ensuring that not only does this person have access, but also has the benefits that the digital economy offers. But you're a public policy student, and if you were to think about the policy measures that would be needed to incentivize both the development of these use cases for the target group that we're talking about, as well as to try and ensure that there is greater digital literacy, what are the kinds of policy moves that you think should become an integral part of political party manifestos in India?
So I will look at perhaps three things. I think first, and this is outside of literacy and use cases, I think the most important thing for access is to increase incomes and bring down device and data prices. I think that is the biggest game changer for access that can exist. But coming more specifically to your question, I think in terms of policy measures to drive this, I think number one, DPI is an important lever. I think DPI being linked to a number of government services has created that use case for several people, perhaps lower down the income ladder. So people who need to access subsidies need to authenticate their Aadhaar, for which quite often they need to get a phone and quite often they need to get a smartphone. I think formal employment is a very big driver. I think it's fairly impossible today to be in formal employment without having WhatsApp to coordinate with a number of people. So I think as the formal economy grows in size, I suspect there will be use cases that emerge both from the private sector and the public sector. So the DPI and government service use cases, as well as the private sector that in the course of formal employment and as part of participation in the formal economy will create those use cases. So looking at policy measures, I would look at driving more and more people into formal systems of employment. And I would look at, as I said, ensuring, I would also look at pushing digital public infrastructure and government services related use cases, because those really matter for a lot of people lower down the income ladder.
So let's come to DPI. DPIs, that's digital public infrastructure and digital public goods, have been a fundamental plank of India's G20 presidency. It's been a fundamental plank of India's approach towards the digital economy. And the idea in that sense is a fairly simple one, we need to create digital public goods that everybody can use and build on to provide products and services that can reach end users. And these digital public goods should be created for the citizenry as a whole and not by a corporation for its own private ends. That in a gist is what the DPI is about. And we can now see examples of that across various sectors, whether it is in payments, whether it is now in shopping, whether it is in travel. There's kind of beginnings or shoots of the DPI that seems to be everywhere. Now, as far as the question of governance is concerned, do you think we run the danger of putting all our eggs in this DPI basket? During the G20 presidency, there were some murmurs, particularly by European countries, that the idea of digital public infrastructure is good. But what if there is an authoritarian government somewhere? Are we okay with that government creating these digital public goods where we don't know what exactly is happening to the data and where it's going? As far as DPI is concerned, you were bullish about the fact that this is the way in which we can get more access and equitable access. And I just want you to reflect a little bit on what the promise of DPI is and what the potential pitfalls that we need to guard against are.
I think the promise of DPI is massive. I think DPI seems to have this, there's this imagination around DPI where it can reshape how the internet perhaps operates, because you have identity, you have payments, and you have service modules now. And all of this together can sort of create a new internet. And there are certainly some optimists and some utopian thinking around those ideals. And there is also on the ground a big push for DPIs in India. I think the G20 experience clearly reflected that. I think one question that we do still need to grapple with is, what exactly do we mean by DPI? Because over time, this definition has evolved. It evolved from just the Jandhan Aadhaar mobile idea to becoming about health records, to then becoming about health services, then also about e-commerce and agricultural data markets and all types of services now, as you mentioned. I think a pitfall there is that the more you move up the stack, I think there is a danger that you can crowd out the private sector. And I think that can perhaps become problematic, because sometimes the best innovation does come from the private sector. And there is a UPI example which I think really nails this. If you look at voice boxes, which are so crucial to UPI adoption for small vendors, I think they're an innovation that was pioneered entirely by the private sector. I'm not sure the state would have come up with that solution In fact, jokingly, sometimes I think the state solution would have been to place an employee near every small vendor who then seeks rents from the vendor for telling them whether the money is being deposited or not. So I think with DPI, we have to be care. I think the question is not so much whether we are putting all our eggs in the DPI basket, but I think what this calls for is slightly greater discipline around the idea of DPI. It needs to remain infrastructure in a sense, which allows other people, which allows the private sector, along with the government, to offer services on top of it. So we want to build digital highways, but we want everyone to be able to travel on these highways, not just the state or national champions that are close to the state.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. But don't you think then that the example that we have at this point of time in payments with UPI, not the voice box example, but the fact that the government has built this fundamental interoperable, the government means whatever, the NPCI has built this fundamental interoperable platform, which will allow and does allow several players providing payment services, whether it is a phone pay or a Paytm or a government run or an NPCI run Bheem, as one of the players providing these services. So if you go up the stack, the up the stack is private innovation. But if you go at the bottom of the stack at the foundational platform level, there is a digital public infrastructure. So do you think that model is a replicable model? Is there anything that we need to be cautious of even in that payments model?
I would call out two things to be very cautious about. I think first, the distinction that you made is actually an important distinction because it was the NPCI that built the UPI. When you take this to other sectors, such as, for example, when you take this to health, now you're talking about ensuring coordination between many hospitals, many health service providers. The scale becomes much bigger than the 13 or 50 banks that eventually are a part of NPCI. So I think in terms of replicability, this is going to be a big challenge to get that type of coordination in different sectors, especially in sectors where a lot of the economy is still informal, is going to be fairly difficult. Banking, in that sense, is a beautiful example because it's been heavily regulated, very much a part of the formal economy, and doesn't have such a large number of players that some of these other sectors do. The second thing I would be cautious about is, and I think some of this is coming home to roost now, is that a lot of the success of UPI was built on the idea of zero merchant fees, so
That's right.
which drove its adoption. But what it also has done today, perhaps, is it's really created a duopoly or maybe an oligopoly at the services layer because you cannot monetize the payments business now. So the only way to do the payments business is to monetize some affiliated business, such as lending or such as data, which is what Google does, or lending, which is what PhonePe and a bunch of the other pays did. So I think when you talk about this type of state-led development, there are often economic implications that play out in the long term. And I think with payments, we might see some of those implications start playing out about now. So those are two things I would be cautious about.
And but if you were to unpack this a little bit further for the listeners, so could you tell us a little bit about NPCI's holding structure, and why you think it worked for banks, and why you think we can't think of a structure maybe similar to that, or kind of some derivative of that for a sector like health, which of course has much larger number of players, as I'm sure. I mean, there are. You can count the number of banks as in whatever in a couple of minutes, but you obviously, if you're looking at health providers, is not even getting into the informal economy. But what strikes me is that maybe you can think of a structure, since it is a digital public good, you can think of a structure where the government, as a representative of the people, has a greater say in that, in whatever the statutory equivalent of NPCI is for health. So could you just tell a little bit about the NPCI structure first, and how you think these structures might play out in other sectors?
Right. So the NPCI is an initiative. It's a non-profit company, so it's a Section 8 company. The shareholders of this company are a number of banks in India, both private and public sector banks, and the Reserve Bank of India, which exercises a degree of oversight over the NPCI. You could think up a similar structure for health, where you have private entities that exercise a lot of influence in the space come together under the framework of a government regulator or a body that sets broad standards and enables this type of cooperation and coordination to build interoperability. The problem is the RBI has traditionally been a very strong regulator with high degrees of capacity. That perhaps cannot be said for regulators in many other sectors. Second, I think banking has been part of the central list. I think when you start talking about subjects that run into federal questions, such as health, the first question is which government maintains oversight over this new entity? Is it the central government, the union government, or are we going to have to give state governments a degree of say in the standard setting? And then how does that play out? So I think it's a tough task when it comes to federal issues, and it's a tough task when it comes to areas where the regulator has not been strong or lacks capacity. I think there are examples of you know, bodies that include state representatives, like the GST Council seems to have done this in the case of taxation. But that's a big effort that took several years and is still improving, if it is. I think we don't know if that type of effort is going to be easily replicable in a bunch of other sectors. It is, I think, but it is work that should be done and will take time, I think.
Yeah, but let's come to the second aspect of what you said in terms of the monetization of these businesses. And of course, one way in which we have seen monetization work is that if the product is free, then we are the product. So essentially, our data is what is fueling this digital economy. And in that context, the government, of course, has recently passed the Digital Personal Data Protection Act. In full disclosure, in a very early version of this bill, Anirudh and I had both worked on it, and that, of course, has taken a slightly different form in the way in which it has ultimately come out. But the optics around it have been that the DPDP Act is both foundational as well as will allow for fostering greater innovation. But of course, the critics have said that this just increases compliance and a regulatory burden. At the end of the day, of course, what it's trying to do is trying to ensure that if you are the product and your data is being used, then it's being used responsibly in a manner in which you have either consented or which you can reasonably anticipate. So I wanted to get your sense on how the DPDP Act is going to affect or not affect the future trajectory of the digital economy in India.
I think my best answer is that only time will tell. I think the process of the data protection law was a long process of negotiation between a bunch of different interests. And I think the private sector and the state were able to align their interests somewhere in the final product. The truth about how innovation friendly this law is will emerge only once it's administered. But I think this idea of fostering innovation very often becomes a dog whistle for let the private sector do what it wants. And I think there is a danger there. I think the administration of the data protection law cannot ignore the fundamental privacy questions and the citizens' rights that are at the heart of the effort to protect people's data, and can't sacrifice that for really vague promises of innovation. So I think as such, it's a fairly decent piece of legislation with maybe some caveats. But I think time will tell, and I think to the extent that this allows the Indian digital economy to start operating in global markets, I think this is a law that puts us on the right track, because that type of interaction will over time improve the law and its administration as well, which I think is really the key thing to look out for. Does this law allow Indian companies to trade with the world easily?
And what do you think are the key facets of this law that enable Indian companies to be on a level playing field with their global counterparts?
I think there are a number of aspects that do that. I think the first one that comes to mind is the perhaps dilution of restrictions on cross-border data flows. There is still a provision around cross-border data flows, but there is a degree of uncertainty. And if you read between the lines, you might make the inference that the government does not have the same type of position on restricting cross-border data flows anymore. I think that's one big aspect of the data protection law. I think some of the deemed consent provisions also enable a lot of smaller players in the chain of data transfers to sort of seamlessly be incorporated within companies' compliances. And I think that's very important, because I think that's the type of provision that allows compliance costs to be reduced, and that also allows sort of greater services to be rolled out to people.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room here, and a pretty massive elephant in the room here is of the fear of surveillance. And while this has been conflated with the data protection question, it is an independent question in and of itself, is that does this tech-enabled modernity that we find ourselves in, and we are kind of even going further into, does this essentially open ourselves up to being surveilled every step of the way by the state, most critically, because it still has the monopoly over violence, as well as by large private sector players who can track our activity on the internet? And in that context, the Data Protection Bill has been widely criticized for the fact that it has large exemptions for the state, particularly for surveillance purposes. There are agencies which are completely exempt from the bill itself. So essentially, the state will be able to surveil you. And this, when it is seen conjointly with the Pegasus scandal, where the phones of several important people were hacked, and we really haven't gotten to the bottom of it in terms of what happened. Did the government actually purchase Pegasus? Did it actually authorize its usage on phones of journalists and opposition members? What exactly happened, we don't know. So when we are sort of in this moment or in this atmosphere of uncertainty about whether we are being surveilled or not, how do you see the Data Protection Act in terms of A, is this a missed opportunity for surveillance reform? And B, how do you see surveillance as being one of these caveats that we need to always remain cautious of while we can remain bullish about the growth of the internet and the promises that it brings?
So this was my big caveat to saying that the data protection law is a fairly decent piece of legislation, that it almost entirely leaves out surveillance reform. I don't want to be a pessimist about this, but I suspect that over time we will find out that this is the world we made, and now this is the world we reside in. I think people have willingly, or perhaps ignorantly, but definitely in a way that they continue doing it, handed over their data to private companies. And I think private companies have faced fairly little pushback outside of a small community of people who sort of argue surveillance capitalism. I think by and large, people are very happy with Instagram tracking their location as long as it recommends the best restaurant to them. With the state, this becomes a much more problematic question. And I think with the state, if you look globally, I am not sure there are any jurisdictions that have done very well on this front. I think in the US, which has formal safeguards for surveillance, intelligence agencies were still able to subvert them using a data broker loophole where they simply purchased all of that data and then had access to it. Not to mention that there is a lot that the NSA probably continues to do that we just don't know about. So I think when you look at surveillance by private entities and by the state, it is a tough moment, because I don't think the political economy for reform exists at the moment. And I think that's why the Data Protection Bill is a missed opportunity, but in some senses, the opportunity was never there, because the political will for this type of reform was never there. And I suspect that in a world where no jurisdiction really leads the way, most countries are going to accept this as the equilibrium, because it serves sort of the national security apparatus's interests. So
I'm just wondering whether you think that there will be a tipping point for something of this nature. I completely agree with you. We have all, in some sense, signed away our data and our privacy for benefits. We perhaps draw our own lines in terms of where and how much we are willing to give up. But I think most of us, at least, who have taken up a smartphone have made some compromise at somewhere down the line, and that is willy-nilly pushing us into the surveillance society. But I was just wondering whether there's a tipping point here somewhere, because the Pegasus scandal, for example, is a wake-up call, but perhaps again not a very public one. That essentially everything you do on your phones could be tracked by the government. So I was just wondering whether you think that there will ever be the political economy for surveillance reform in India or in the US for that matter.
I think there are, of course, I can't rule out the possibility of surveillance reform. I think there are certain types of events that can drive an imperative for regulation. I think certain types of moral panics can sometimes create a need for governments to assuage their people. So if the people of a country are enthralled in a moral panic about how much surveillance their government does, there might be the political economy for the government to assuage those demands. What I do think, though, is that those tipping points, if they happen, will happen by chance and by a confluence of a number of variables that align at the same time. What I think we are seeing and what I think we will see is that we are becoming a much more networked society. As we become a much more networked and much more interdependent society, the costs of any type of malicious act increase because the scale at which you can perform those malicious acts increases. And I think the natural response to that is an increase in surveillance by government. So I am actually fairly pessimistic about this, but I think it's an implication of interdependence that surveillance reform is only more unlikely 5 years later than it is now.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And of course, as in, I guess something that has pushed us towards the surveillance society is also 9/11, which led to a raft of legislation that gives wide and sweeping powers to the national security apparatus to collect data, and also ensure that there is very limited oversight over that collection. But whether there will be some kind of counter 9/11 at some point of time, which goes the other way in terms of regulation, we'll just have to wait and see. This actually brings me to the last area that I want to discuss, which is an area without which no discussion on the internet is complete today, which is artificial intelligence. And as you said, that we're perhaps looking at a different construct of the internet going forward. That is not going to be the way in which we think of the internet today in terms of websites that you visit on a World Wide Web, but perhaps it's going to be much closer to you. It's going to be everywhere, all pervasive. You're always on the internet. You don't have to log into the internet. And we have these various visions, whether you call it metaverse or you call it something else, there are various visions of how the digital world is essentially going to fundamentally change, and that change is going to be made possible by artificial intelligence of various kinds, as I meant. So I want you to reflect a little bit on how you think artificial intelligence and products that are based on artificial intelligence, A, will shape the future of the internet, and B, will shape our daily lives as citizens.
I think artificial intelligence is the hot button topic right now, and we could keep talking for another hour about all of the ways in which AI and the developments in AI over the last 4 years may impact us, may impact society. And I think many of the issues that are talked about, like bias, like copyright, like job losses, I think all of those apply to the Indian context as well. To your question about first how it will change the internet, I think AI will democratize the production of a lot of content and a lot of internet products. So I think people being able to code using AI assistants will be able to create websites and services. And this, in some sense, lowers the barrier of entry for becoming a seller in the digital economy in a way. I think the other thing it will do is it will create this entire new world of content creation where we are no longer limited by individual creative abilities or by individual abilities to translate a vision into reality. I think we have a very powerful machine now that can actually dream up many kinds of realities that perhaps humans too cannot. So I think there are a lot of changes that will happen to the internet because of AI and because of the way in which it makes producing content and producing digital services and products easier. I think in terms of how it will affect us, I think we might become very reliant on AI tools as they proliferate. I know that right now I use ChatGPT as an academic assistant for all of my courses. In fact, one of these days I was thinking about how people did this course in 2018, which is 6 years ago, if you think about it. But there has been, I think, already a big shift in terms of the tools that are available to people. And I think people are very happy to use AI in that sense. What
so
I
this
do
actually
think
brings me to the question of AI regulation. We found that at least the government of India has not taken a very consistent position on this. You hear sounds here and there that one, we are not going to regulate it because we want to be a market that's open for disruption and innovation. And so there's going to be no regulation. But then suddenly there is a old license Raj style advisory that gets issued that any product that is based on generative AI that is put out in the Indian market has to require the prior permission of the government of India, of course, subsequently withdrawn. So the question that arises is that what is the optimal way in which we are looking at regulating AI, number one. Number two, are we really looking at it as a horizontal cutting across areas of all forms of AI? Because that seems to me to be, at this point of time, a little bit naive. Or are we really looking at it much more in a sector-specific way, given the fact that AI is going to be pervasive and it perhaps doesn't make sense to do something that is straight up across the board, because the way in which it will work in health is, again, very different from the way in which it will work in helping you do your academic assignments. And we can't think about regulating it similarly. So your thoughts on regulating AI and this horizontal versus vertical question.
Right. So let me take the first part of that question. I think in terms of how we think about regulating AI, there is a lot to be learned from the big tech experience in terms of preventing monopolies from emerging, in terms of ensuring accountability and ensuring a degree of transparency in how these AI models operate. I think it's important to not be reactionary about this. And I think that is also a lesson from the big tech experience, that reactionary regulation does not work. And ultimately, without sustained engagement with high technology industries, it's very difficult to regulate them. What I think India needs to do definitely is not become a hostile market for the best AI products, which means this type of ill-advised advisory is a bad idea. The frame in which I would think about AI regulation is a frame that I borrow from Acemoglu's arguments in Power and Progress, where he says that the effects of technology on society are not deterministic. They depend on a series of social, political, and institutional choices we make that will determine the winners and losers from any new technology. I think this actively needs to be the frame with which we think about regulating AI. With every decision, we must think about who wins and who loses from that decision. And I suspect that really, given the nascent state of this technology, this is not the time to be very heavy-handed with regulation. I suspect it's time to actually steward AI into a direction where it is productive and where it creates more winners than losers. On the second part of your question about this horizontal was a sector-specific regulation, I think horizontal regulation of AI is going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, or if not, you know, counterproductive. I think regulating training data and regulating inputs is a difficult path to go down, especially when we don't know whether that will actually guarantee the types of outcomes we want in AI outputs. I think regulating foundation models sort of in this general way depends really on a high degree of institutional capacity within the government to do that as well. And I think that is perhaps lacking across governments, even in the most advanced governments at the moment. So to my mind, the preferred approach would be to remain sector specific to regulate outputs instead of inputs, and to perhaps adopt a sort of audit and report framework where you can incrementally understand how these AI models function and what types of changes will lead to which kinds of outcomes. I think a lot of that knowledge is essentially shrouded in a cloud of mystique right now. And I think going ahead and making regulations for this technology when we don't even know how those regulations will affect the technology is perhaps premature and foolhardy. So I would suggest a hands off.
So let me take a practical example and we'll have to end it after that. So I was looking at this ongoing class action lawsuit in the US against RealPage, which you may have heard of, which is an AI-based service that connects and negotiates rental agreements between homeowners and potential tenants. And negotiating rental prices is entirely delegated to the algorithm. The algorithm does this without any human interface. And RealPage has been alleged in this class action lawsuit to have facilitated collusion between persons. So the prices quoted by RealPage to tenants were indeed inflated, though there hasn't been any evidence of direct communication between property owners using RealPage. It seems to have been something that the algorithm did. So this is technically tacit collusion, if you were to see it in competition terms, but is not a violation of the US Sherman Act. So questions of antitrust accountability for anti-competitive conduct by fully autonomous AI systems have now come to the fore. So if we are to deal with a question like this of an AI system that is essentially violating some law, which by bar engaging in some practice, it could get much worse with questions of discrimination and so on. I'm not getting into that. But do you think that even in this sort of situation, we do wait and watch? Or do we think about some forms of ex ante regulation, some basic safeguards that all algorithms or developers of algorithms have to follow?
So let me give you my general view and an example, which I think really sets out the approach that might work. My general view is that a minimum level of ex ante principles or safeguards can, of course, be legislated. But whether they are actually implemented and incorporated within these models is something that will depend on being able to see behind the veil and be able to have access to how these models are operating. And I think that is something that remains difficult to do. So principle-based regulation sometimes only goes so far, and big tech's lawyers are fairly good at developing documentation that seems to comply with all of the requirements of principle-based regulation. I think ex ante regulation within competition law is a somewhat different question, and I think there it makes a lot of sense because it's very difficult to turn the clock back once platforms become monopolies, given how platform economics operates. Let me take a specific example to talk about these practical types of questions. And I think this will actually address sort of like even the deeper questions about discrimination. So Facebook's ad delivery algorithm was alleged by many to be biased in terms of it showed some houses disproportionately more to white people than to black people, even though the person who was targeting an audience said, I want this ad to be shown to 50% a white audience and 50% a black audience. Now, somewhere within the algorithm, there is a skew. It is very difficult to legislate that skew away. Ultimately, how this was solved in the US was that the Department of Justice pursued a lawsuit against Meta, which resulted in a settlement, which resulted in several rounds of negotiation with Meta, where the DOJ got privileged access to how these algorithms were functioning and was then able to make or recommend the specific prescriptions that might reduce that type of discrimination. So I think given the number of areas in which AI is being used, I think housing in terms of job screening, in terms of giving out credit, in terms of bail applications, right? I think there are clear cases where we need to be alive and we can't just be hands off and say, let this go on. But I think the way in which we are alive has to be a sustained engagement with these companies in the framework of a settlement or in the framework of a lawsuit. I think it's very difficult to legislate for these types of issues in AI today.
Absolutely. And I think A wait and watch policy makes sense for a number of reasons, and apart from the fact that we may not be able to do anything else apart from just being vigilant. So I think this has been an engrossing conversation. But last word to you, Anirudh. So the elections in India are around the corner, and a government is going to be elected come 4th of June. And so if you had a wish list of 2 to 3 major policy moves in the tech space that you would like to see, what would those be? Very briefly.
Well, I think very briefly is the difficult part of this question. What I would really like to
I thought
see
two to
is
three might be the difficult part.
that's an open question. I think number one, I would like to see commitments to increasing access. I would like to see concrete commitments that go outside of setting up a fund of sorts that perhaps never really gets utilized in that way. Those concrete commitments should perhaps come with measurable targets, should perhaps come with a series of economic proposals about tariffs and customs and tax rates that reduce device and data prices and that increase incomes. The second thing I would like to see is I would like to see a structural mechanism through which free speech and content moderation issues are addressed within India. I think right now the executive and the government is struggling as much with this problem as civil society and citizens are because there is no answer to who is responsible for, let's say, some degree of hygiene around content online. I think this needs sustained engagement from all sides of the aisle, but I would like to see a structural mechanism that preserves civil liberties, that preserves a degree of independence, but also creates sort of the base framework which can then be improved upon. And perhaps the third and final thing I would like to see is I would like to see digital public infrastructure rolled out across a number of sectors. In sort of a minimal way where it is about infrastructure and that allows the private sector to build upon it. So expanding beyond payments and commerce to education, to employment, to agriculture. I think that's the third big push that I would really like to see.
Thanks very much, Anirudh. I think that's those are three big pushes, and you've been very brief in giving those answers. And I hope that the policymakers do listen, because that's really the direction in which India needs to go. So thank you very much, Anirudh, for an engrossing conversation. I certainly enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners did too. So do keep joining us for future episodes of Justify.
As we close, let's reveal the question for today's Free and Fair, our special audience poll, where, as the listeners, you get to exercise your franchise. Today's question: is the Digital Personal Data Protection Act a net positive? Vote yes or no. To cast your vote, visit my Twitter account @orgo_justify or Vidhi's LinkedIn page in the next 48 hours. Adjourn.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, follow us on Twitter @Vidhi_India for regular updates. We are on SoundCloud and Spotify as Vidhi Center for Legal Policies podcast. You can also listen to us on Google Podcasts or iTunes. Email us at justify@vidhilegalpolicy.in to share your comments and feedback on this episode.